Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Agriculture Report and Science in the News, coming up after As It Is.
Hello, and welcome back to the show that helps you learn and improve your American English and teaches you about our world at the same time. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Thank you for joining us. Today, we have one serious item and one that is much more fun to hear about. First, we tell about spies using computers in an unfair way in the business world. Then, we will hear about some brave people who hope to sail a special boat around the world without using any instruments to guide them, just like sailors used to do it many years ago. So pull up a chair, relax for a bit, and then listen to the program on radio or on the internet. As It is coming to you from Washington. The United States recently charged 5 Chinese military officers with spying on American metal, nuclear, and solar power companies. China immediately rejected the accusations. The charges are evidence of a basic disagreement about what the two countries consider their national security interests. As Ana Mateo reports, that disagreement has affected relations between China and the U.S.
The U.S. government says Chinese spies are secretly using computers at United States Steel Corporation to learn how to reduce steel production costs. Officials say lower prices would drive down world steel prices and company profits. U.S. Steel has cut production and reduced the size of its workforce. In Beijing, Chinese Foreign Ministry official Hong Lei angrily dismissed the charges. He said the U.S. move once again shows what he called the domineering attitude and hypocrisy of the U.S. He said China has urged the U.S. to correct its mistakes and remove the so-called charges. Ben Fitzgerald works for the Center for a New American Security, a public policy group in Washington, D.C. He notes that the U.S. government is reported to have spied on foreign companies, but he says it has not done so for economic gain.
We use it for national security, to do counterterrorism or for state-on-state related intelligence collection, so that our diplomats are better prepared, so that our military professionals know what's coming, as opposed to trying to help our businesses succeed. That's just not part of our conception of how business is done.
However, China considers economic gain as part of its national security interests.
They have a much closer relationship between the health of their economy and their businesses and their national security. Whereas in a U.S. and often a European context, we see those as separate activities.
President Barack Obama and Chinese President Xi Jinping have discussed the industrial espionage issue repeatedly. Jay Carney is a spokesman for Mr. Obama.
This is an issue that has been brought up by President Obama with President Xi in their meetings as recently as in March as a general problem that we have seen and reflects the president's overall concern about cybersecurity.
Yet, as Ben Fitzgerald notes, the charges are a sign that the discussions were not working.
This is really a result of a breakdown in communication between China and the U.S., or a lack of Chinese involvement in taking this problem seriously in closed-door conversations. So now the administration has chosen to make this a public dialogue rather than a private one.
Up until now, the public dialogue has not led to any agreement on this issue. I'm Ana Mateo.
For the first time, a Hawaiian voyaging canoe is sailing around the world. The goal of the trip is to explore how to care for the earth and its oceans. As we hear from Mario Ritter, the people sailing the canoe are using the ancient art of wayfinding to guide the boat on its way.
A Hawaiian voyaging canoe named Hokulea first sailed from Hawaii to Tahiti in 1976. At the time, no one thought the trip would lead to a renewed interest in Polynesian voyaging throughout the Pacific Ocean. The double-hulled canoe became an important sign of local culture. The boat has two support floats, which are tied together. Ben Finney was the first president of the Polynesian Voyaging Society, which made the canoe. Mr. Finney is now 82 years old. He says he and his team wanted to demonstrate it was possible for Polynesians to have explored and settled islands in the Pacific.
Our primary motivation in building and sailing and navigating canoes was to have Hawaiians and other Polynesians and other Pacific Islanders take over the leadership in relearning, reinventing the technology, and in putting it to use and demonstrating its use. So it becomes their project, not my project.
Ben Finney says the Polynesian Voyaging Society wanted to bring back the art of wayfinding, navigating or sailing a canoe without instruments. Years ago, crews guided their boats only by the stars, winds, waves, birds, and other signs of nature. The tradition had been lost in Polynesia. The society turned to an expert navigator in Micronesia. Under his guidance, Nainoa Thompson became the first Hawaiian in 600 years to use the art of wayfinding. He also combined the tradition with modern science. Since then, Mr. Thompson has trained a whole new generation of navigators. Now, he is going on an around-the-world trip called Malama Hanua, or Caring for Our Earth. He says several people influenced his decision to make the trip. They included his friend, the former American astronaut, Lacey Veach.
And he kept saying, I know you need to know how beautiful your island Earth is. It's just one island in space. It's all we got. There's no other island that we can go to. And it's fragile, and it needs to be protected, and Hokulea needs to help us learn and find the way. Take it around the world. That was 22 years ago.
To prepare for the trip, Nainoa Thompson and his crew spent a year sailing around the Hawaiian islands. They used Hokulea, which means Star of Gladness, and a new canoe called Hikianalia. Both are named after stars that navigators use to guide them back to Hawaii. The crew plans to visit more than 20 countries. One goal of the trip is to influence young people and strengthen a new generation of sailors and navigators. That is why half the crew is under the age of 30. Nainoa Thompson hopes many people will follow the trip online at hokulea.com.
If you don't teach children how to take care of the world, they won't have the tools to do that. So we're not going to go save the world, us guys. All we're trying to do with Hokulea and Hikianalia is do our part, and our part is to sail. And so we want to join that human movement of kindness and compassion on the planet with the belief that collectively we can make a difference.
Once the canoes leave Hawaiian waters, they are not expected to return until 2017. I'm Mario Ritter.
And
I'm Jim Tedder. Two more Learning English programs are just seconds away, and there is world news at the beginning of the hour on VOA. Aloha.
The Agriculture Report is next, followed by Science in the News. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Agriculture Report. Most kinds of rose plants come from Asia, but roses are also native to other areas, including Northwest Africa, Europe, and the United States. In 1986, the U.S. Congress chose the rose as America's national flower. Technically, Congress and President Ronald Reagan declared it the national floral emblem. Whatever the name, the decision did not smell sweet to lovers of other flowers. Some people say roses are difficult to grow, but you have a good chance of success if you start with a few suggestions from experts. You should plant your roses where they can get sunshine for about 6 hours on bright days. You can buy roses from a garden center or by mail order. You can buy potted roses, also known as container roses or bare root plants. Each kind has its fans. Some gardeners say potted roses are easier to plant. They say the roots develop better. But Jeffrey Dinslodge, president of Nature Hills Nursery in Omaha, Nebraska, points out that bare root roses come without soil, so they weigh less to transport. The University of Illinois Extension advises getting bare root roses as close to planting time as you can. If they arrive before you are ready to plant them, make sure the packing material is moist. Keep the plants in a cool, dark place. You plant the roses while they are dormant. The resting plants have no leaves, but still need water. When growing roses, the soil should feel moist deep down. Watering should be done in the morning. That can prevent problems called black spot and mildew. But do not water too much. Jeffrey Dinslodge says people often ask him about unhealthy discoloration on rose leaves. He says the spots are usually caused by too much water. After heavy rains or too much watering, he advises pulling away mulch temporarily from around the roots. This will help dry the soil. In normal conditions, placing mulch around rose plants is a good idea. Mulch suppresses weeds and holds moisture in the soil. You can use mulch made from bark, pine needles, cottonseed, or oak leaves. If your soil is very dry, you can add peat or compost, which returns nutrients to the soil. If aphids, thrips, or other insects invade your rose bushes, you may be able to force them off with just a strong spray of water. And that's the Agriculture Report. I'm Mario Ritter.
This is Science in the News. I'm Shirley Griffith.
And I'm Christopher Cruz. Today, we tell the stories of some medical heroes.
At the start of the 20th century, the United States Army had a yellow fever commission. The Army wanted medical experts to study yellow fever and find a way to stop the disease. One team went to Cuba to test the idea that mosquitoes spread yellow fever. The team was led by Walter Reed, the Army doctor and scientist noted for his work on infectious diseases. In August of 1900, the researchers began to raise mosquitoes and infect them with the virus. 9 of the Americans let the infected insects bite them. Nothing happened. Then 2 more let the mosquitoes bite them. Both men developed yellow fever.
A doctor named Jesse William Lazier recognized that the mosquitoes that bit the last 2 men had been older than the others. Dr. Lazier proved that mosquitoes did carry yellow fever. Dr. Lazier himself was also bitten. No one is sure how it happened. He said it happened accidentally as he treated others. But some people said he placed the mosquito on his arm as part of the experiment. Medical historians say he may have reported the bite as an accident, so his family would not be denied money from his life insurance policy.
Jesse Lazier died of yellow fever. His death shocked the others on the team in Cuba, but they continued their work. More people let themselves be bitten by mosquitoes. Others were injected with blood from the victims of yellow fever. Some people in this test group developed the disease, but all recovered to full health. Members of the team praised the work by Jesse Lazier. They called it a sacrifice to research that led the way to one of the greatest medical discoveries of the century.
The research answered the question of how yellow fever was spread. Now the question was how to protect people. The researchers had a theory. They thought that people who were bitten by infected mosquitoes, but recovered, were protected in the future. To test this idea, the team in Cuba offered $100 to anyone who would agree to be bitten by infected mosquitoes. 19 people agreed. The only American was Clara Moss. She was a nurse who worked with yellow fever patients in Cuba. Clara Moss was bitten by infected mosquitoes 7 times between March and August of 1901. Only 1 of the 19 people developed the disease until that August. Then, 7 people got yellow fever. Clara Moss died 6 days after she was bitten for the 7th time.
The experiment showed that the bite of an infected mosquito was not a safe way to protect people from yellow fever. Medical historians say the death of Clara Moss also created a public protest over the use of humans in yellow fever research. Such experiments ended. Cuba and the United States both honored Clara Moss on postage stamps. And today, a hospital in her home state of New Jersey is known as the Clara Moss Medical Center.
Joseph Goldberger was a doctor for the United States Public Health Service. In 1912, he began to study a skin disease that was killing thousands of people in the South. The disease was pellagra. Dr. Goldberger traveled to the state of Mississippi, where many people suffered from pellagra. He studied the victims and their families. Most of the people were poor. The doctor came to believe that the disease was not infectious, but instead related to diet. He received permission from the state governor to test this idea at a prison. Prisoners were offered pardons if they took part. One group of prisoners received their usual foods, mostly corn products. A second group ate meat, fresh vegetables, and milk. Members of the first group developed pellagra. The second group did not.
But some medical researchers refused to accept that a poor diet caused pellagra. For the South, pellagra was more than simply a medical problem. There were other issues involved, including Southern pride. So Dr. Goldberger had himself injected with blood from a person with pellagra. He also took liquid from the nose and throat of a pellagra patient and put them into his own nose and throat. He even swallowed pills that contained skin from pellagra patients. An assistant also took part in the experiments. So did Dr. Goldberger's wife. None of them got sick. Later, the doctor discovered that a small amount of dried brewer's yeast each day could prevent pellagra. Joseph Goldberger died of cancer in 1929. He was 55 years old. Several years later, researchers discovered the exact cause of pellagra, a lack of the B vitamin known as niacin.
Matthew Luquia was the medical administrator of St. Mary's Hospital in the Gulu district of northern Uganda. In 2000, the hospital was the center of treatment for an outbreak of Ebola. The virus causes severe bleeding. No cure is known. Doctors can only hope that victims are strong enough to survive. Dr. Luquia acted quickly to control the spread of infection. He kept the people with Ebola separate from the other patients. He ordered hospital workers to wear protective clothing and follow other safety measures. One day, he had to deal with a patient who was dying of Ebola. The man had been acting out of control. The doctor knew him well. The patient was a nurse who worked at the hospital. The man was coughing and bleeding. Dr. Luquia violated one of his own rules. He wore no protection over his eyes. Matthew Luquia died from the virus in December of 2000. He was only 42 years old. Ugandans mourned his death. He was an important influence in the community. Experts say his work during the outbreak helped stop the Ebola virus from spreading out of control.
On February 28, 2003, the Vietnam France Hospital in Hanoi asked Carlo Urbani for help. The Italian doctor was an expert on communicable diseases. He was based in Vietnam for the World Health Organization. The hospital asked Dr. Urbani to help identify an unusual infection. He recognized it as a new threat. he made sure other hospitals increased their infection control measures. On March 11th, Dr. Urbani developed signs of severe acute respiratory syndrome. 4 days later, the World Health Organization declared it a worldwide health threat. Carlo Urbani was the first doctor to warn the world of the disease that became known as SARS. He died of it on March 29, 2003. He was 46 years old.
Our final medical hero is an American, molecular biologist Anita Roberts. She was widely recognized by other researchers for her work with a protein called transforming growth factor beta. TGF-beta can both heal wounds and make healthy cells cancerous. In 1976, Anita Roberts joined the National Cancer Institute, part of the National Institutes of Health. She worked for many years with another researcher, Michael Sporn. They found that TGF-beta helps to heal wounds and is important in the body's defense system against disease. At the same time, though, the two scientists found that the protein can also support the growth of cancer in some cells.
Between 1983 and 2002, Anita Roberts published more than 340 research papers. Many other scientists gave credit to her published work. In fact, the publication Science Watch listed her as the 49th most cited researcher in the world during that 20-year period. She was the third most cited female scientist. But in 2004, after years of studying cancer, Anita Roberts learned that she herself had the disease. She died of gastric cancer in May of 2006. She was 64 years old.
Our program was written by Nancy Steinbach and George Groh. June Sims was our producer. I'm Christopher Cruz.
And I'm Shirley Griffith. We hope you join us again next week for more news about science on The Voice of America.